Okay, Baruchim Abayim, ladies. We're studying Parashat Chaye Sarah. Parashat Chaye Sarah talks about not the life of Sarah, but actually talks about the death of Sarah Eminu. It's ironic that when we talk about the death of the Tzadeket, the name of the parasha should be Mitat Sarah, the death of Sarah. Chaye Sarah is not appropriate. However, it is appropriate. Because when we talk about the death of the Tzadikim, our rabbis tell us Tzadikim never die. They always live. Their lessons, their teachings, their values perpetuate in their children and their grandchildren and their students. Therefore, we are all considered students of Sarah Eminu. When we read her life and we read what she did about her modesty and about her keen perception, we learn for ourselves how to act. So even though Sarah is buried underground and she's physically dead, but the teachings of Sarah never die. Therefore, in the parasha that discusses her death, it is called the life of Sarah, Chaye Sarah. Important point. Chaye Sarah is preceded by the Akedat Yitzhak. And the rabbis tell us there's a connection between the death of Sarah and Akedat Yitzhak. It's actually somewhat upsetting of a connection. Our rabbis tell us after Abraham came back from Akedat Yitzhak, he passed, according to most opinions, the 10th and final test. And now he comes home to see his wife dead. His wife, for over a century, is married to Sarah, and she dies. What's the connection? Why would God do that to Abraham Avinu? Some rabbis learn that this actually was the Satan's way of trying to destroy the Akedat Yitzhak. We have a rule. A person does a mitzvah, he gets credit. But if you regret the mitzvah, you lose it. For example, a fellow came to synagogue in the morning to pray. He woke up, he got excited, he came, he learned. And then he came back to his car to find some tickets, some parking tickets on the car. And he got very upset. And he says to himself, if I would have known that I was going to get these tickets, I wouldn't have came to shul in the first place. At that moment, there's regret, he loses the mitzvah. He has to know that the Satan is very diligent at his job. The Satan will try to stop you from doing the mitzvah before you get there. He'll put impediments on the way, not to get you out of bed. So even if you beat him and you got out of bed, know the Satan is still lingering to try to steal the mitzvah out of your pocket. How does he do that? By regret. Therefore, Avraham Avinu just passed Akedat Yitzhak. It's a big score. Satan is very, very dismayed, very upset that Avraham succeeded with such flying colors. So what does the Satan do? He makes a perception as if Sarah died because of the Akedah. The rabbis tell us that when Sarah heard that Yitzhak was taken to be slaughtered, she had a heart attack and died. The rabbis tell us that there were some giants, and she went to the giants that were living and said, I heard news, something that my husband is slaughtering my son, something like that. Could you verify that for me? And they took a telescopic look on all the mountains. And they said, yes, we see on top of this mountain over here, a man with a son, and he's holding a knife. She said, Dachilak, they're right. He's killing my son. She died. So when Abraham comes home, Sarah's dead. The Satan wants Abraham to say, if I would have known that this would have killed my wife, I wouldn't have gone in the first place. Abraham's Akedat Yitzhak, the test was not over until he came home and buried his wife. And his reaction was, if the Pasuk says, at the funeral, it writes, Vayavu Avram nespod leSarah. He came and eulogized his wife, Vilifkota, and he cried. But if you look in the Chumash, ladies, in the word Vilifkota, the Kaf, Livkota, is written small. Our rabbis all ask, why is the Kaf written small? To teach us, he cried, but he didn't cry so much.
Meaning, why, he didn't love his wife? Of course he loved his wife. But why was he crying? He was only crying because of his wife, not because he regretted what he did in Akedat Yitzchak. Hence, the chaf is small to tell us he passed the test. He didn't overcry and say, it's my fault. That's another lesson. Sarah was going to die regardless, our rabbis say. And you have to know this. It was written in Shamayim, she's going to live 127 years. Everybody's number is written in Shamayim. Now, to somebody that doesn't know that rule, you might say, ah, Akedat Yitzchak did her in. She wouldn't have heard the news, she wouldn't have died. No, she would have died anyway. She would have had another disease or another problem. And that's important for people to know when they're dealing with ailing parents and things like that. Many times children, after a parent passes away, they regret, maybe I could have done more, maybe it was my fault, if I would have went and if I would have done. So long as the child acted responsibly and did not act recklessly and not provide medicine and not do what a normal child would do, that's Borei Olam's business. A child sometimes can add years to his parents' life by doing, extra, but then to blame yourself, to say that was you, she would have died anyway. And that's the lesson to Abraham. That's why Abraham knows that. It's not my fault. Abraham could have said, oh, I'm guilty. If I would have not done the Akedah, I could have gave more years to Sarah. It's not your fault, Abraham. It looks that way, but she was dying anyway. Hence, Abraham cries, but he doesn't cry with a full measure of tears because he knows it's the will of God. It should be pointed out that Tzaddikim never rest in this world. You know, somebody would say, give Abraham a break. He passed Akedat Yitzchak, finished, leave him alone, let him retire in peace. It's not enough what he went through in his life. Now let him go home and live with his wife, at least his old age, they can enjoy themselves to relax. From here the rabbis teach us, Tzaddikim never rest. It's from one test to another test, and Abraham knows that. Therefore, when he came home and saw Sarah dead, he doesn't tell God, enough already, enough, I can't take it anymore, Hashem. Because he realizes that in this world you're constantly elevating. It should be pointed out he came home alone. Where was Yitzhak? Exactly. He sent Yitzhak to yeshiva right after Akedat Yitzhak. You'd figure normal parents, Yitzhak, come home, relax. You just went through a crisis. Take a week off of school like we do to our children. Any little minor issue they have, take a day off here, take a day off over there. Take the summer, take this week, take that week. Because our children are fragile. In the olden days, Yitzhak just finishes Akedat Yitzhak. Abraham tells him, momentum. Keep the momentum. Now go to yeshiva. Go study. It's like a person that was wanted to heat water. He put it on the fire. Right before it was about to boil, he took it off. He put it back on again. It was about to boil, he took it off. The rabbi told him, you can do this all day, it'll never boil unless you have consistency. You must keep it on the fire for a certain amount of time, otherwise it'll never boil. Abraham understood that with his children. If there's no consistency in their religious life, and we keep on teaching them, and then we stop, and we teach, and we stop. I know there's some experiences in our community, the difference between the children in June and in September. In June, our children are on fire, they're studying, they're in a schedule, they have fluency in reading, fluency in understanding the Gemara and the Mishnah. And then, because of the custom of our country, they endure a 2.5 month vacation. And sometimes it's a vacation from learning also. In September, they have regressed immeasurably. They have regressed and it takes 3 or 4 months just to catch them up to where they were last year and then to continue the year after and to go further. It's a terrible thing. There should never be a break in anybody's religious life. Not to say that we don't deserve vacations or need vacations, but even on vacations, there can never be a lapse, whether it's minyan, whether it's learning, whether it's some form of religious behavior. Our religion applies 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. There is never a vacation. Is there sometimes lightening up? Yes, we agree. But to say, I need a vacation totally, you see, Abraham didn't think that way. Abraham didn't let this break him, and that's the way he treated his son. Go to yeshiva now. And Yitzhak understood it. And he went. There's another lesson to be learned from the connection between the death of Sarah and Avraham returning from Akedat Yitzhak. Our rabbis tell us, Rabbi Desla actually says, you know what the test of Avraham was? He now needs to buy a plot for his wife. So he goes to fellows called Ephron. Ephron is the salesman here that's going to sell Avraham a property that belongs to who? That belongs to Avraham. Remember, God gave the land to Avraham. He owns the Me'arat HaMachpelah. He doesn't have to negotiate with anybody. He does not have to make deals. He does not have to bargain. It's his land. Technically, he could come along. Now, this Ephron man over here, who's a Shylock, is going to come along and tell Avraham, well, you know, it's my land over here, but you're a good man. You're a prince in our midst, he says. Take it. Now, Avraham can tell him, oh, don't do me any favors. I don't know who you are. I don't know who put you in charge of this property. God gave me the land. Here's the contract. Go jump in the lake. Have a nice day, and I'll see you later. I'm burying my wife. And he has to negotiate. At the end of the day, Ephron gives him not such an easy time. You know, Ephron starts off the conversation, take it for nothing. My pleasure. I would never think of charging you. And as the conversation goes on, Avraham understands that Ephron doesn't only want to charge him, but he wants to kill him. He wants to beat him. He tells him at the end of the conversation, Avraham, I'm not going to charge you for this property. Anyway, what's a quarter of $1 million between friends? Avraham understands human nature. Once he mentions the price, that's another way of saying, you better pay. What do you have to mention the price for? And the price of the property, if he did own it, was only worth $10,000. So not only did he charge him, but he charges him more than 20 times the value of the price. So Avraham over here is getting beat. Not only that he has to pay this man that doesn't own the property, that he has to pay him an exorbitant amount of money. He just endured Akedat Yitzhak, which is a great pressure on him, and now his wife is dead. Do you give Avraham the right to be a little feisty? If Avraham is a little, if he's a little snappy with Ephron, do you give him a little leeway? You say, Hazit, he has a right to tell Ephron, you know, we do it all the time. Somebody comes to us and we're a little rude to them. And they say, why are you being rude to me? We say, oh, yeah, you don't know, I was in traffic, I had a hard day. For us, the littlest inconvenience, we allow ourselves to be disgusting. To talk fresh, to talk wise, to answer back, to be rude. And the people that we're rude to understand that as an excuse. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know you had a bad day. As if having a bad day excuses unethical behavior. We do it all the time. If there was anybody that ever had an excuse to be rude, it's Avraham Avinu. It's his land. They're charging him a crazy amount of money. They're playing games with him. His wife is there in front of him. He just came back. He's having at least to say a very hard day. But you know what Avraham's test was, and he passed it again? You know how he's dealing with Ephron? Like a gentleman of gentlemen. He bows to him. He calls him sir. He calls him my master. Please, no, I insist. Thank you. He's talking to him like he's talking to a rabbi that's doing him a favor. Throughout the whole conversation, he does not say one bad word. He does not step out of line. He keeps the formality that's befitting of a prince that Avraham was. And God says, you passed the test. You have not imposed bad character, even though you're not having a good day. They tell a story of Rav Yisrael Salanter. Not Rav Yisrael Salanter, excuse me. Rav Shlomo Zalman Oyebach, Zecher Tzaddik Livracha. Shlomo Zalman Oyebach was in the hospital. His wife had just passed away. He just got the news in the hospital. Of course, the rabbi's broken, shattering. That moment, a student, whose wife also was in the hospital, just gave birth. So the student sees Rosh Shlomo Zalman in the hospital. He says, I can't believe it. My Rosh Hashiva's over here. He runs to tell Rosh Shlomo Zalman, my wife had a baby boy. And the rabbi starts smiling. Mabruk, I'm so happy. He's hugging him, kissing him. Good work. And the students tell the rabbi, what are you doing, Mabruk, and smiling? He says, just because I'm having a difficult night, he does not deserve a hearty smile. He does not deserve the proper congratulations, the proper blessings. We cannot impose on people to be rude to them just because things are not working our way. It's a very important lesson, especially in religion many times. People use religion as an excuse not to be courteous. What do I mean? A fellow is walking down the street. Of course, he's a serious man. Obviously, he's thinking of Torah. Obviously, his mind is in the upper worlds. And a friend of his walks by, or an acquaintance walks by, and to tell him good morning, or to tell him a smile, or to show him a nice, courteous face, this will compromise his seriousness. This will compromise the moment. And therefore he justifies, well, because I'm serious and because I'm thinking of religion, therefore I steal a hello or good morning from my friend. And the fellow has a right to respond. Hazaka Baruch, I'm very proud of you. Just because you decided to take this path, what did I do? What did I sin? Human courteous demands, courtesy demands, that when you see somebody in the street, regardless of what you're involved in, even if it's a religious pursuit, one must pause for a moment and make the proper greeting and make the proper smile. On the contrary, that is religion. Yohanan ben Zakkai used to say good morning to every single person in the marketplace, even a Gentile, in order to show the proper courtesy. Now, what are you thinking of? Yohanan, when he was walking in the street, I guarantee you, he was thinking of Torah. He wasn't walking like a tourist. His mind was thinking of the highest levels. But when somebody came in front of him, he put his level on the side and acted ethical like he's supposed to. No different than Avraham Avinu. And that was the test. Is he going to act like a prince when he's not expected to? And he passed that test, as we said. Sarah Imenu lived 127 years. It's interesting the way the Torah tells that to us. Torah says, Me'ah shana, Eslim shana, V'sheva shanim. A lot of extra words here. The Torah could have just said, Me'ah ve'eslim v'sheva shanim. It says 100 years, 20 years, and 7 years. Years, years, years. What is this repetition of the word years? Shana, shana, shanim. Our rabbis tell us there are three parts of a person's life. There's the young age, the person's a child, and then you have the middle age, and then you have the old age. Many people squander away the youth. They're playing, they're enjoying, they're not serious. And then when middle age comes also, they might take advantage of some of the years. But most of the years they're involved in material pursuit and they're involved in their strongest years of their life and they're running after this world. And then by the time they get old, so they're too tired to really pursue religion and therefore it's squandered also. Our Torah is telling us Sarah was different. Me'ah, when she was old lady in her senior years, Shana, they were years. The years counted. She took advantage of them. Esrim, when she was in the Esrim, when she was in the 20s, when she was in the middle of her life. Shana, they were years. She took advantage. She didn't waste her time. Vesheva, even when she was 7, even when she was a child. Vesheva, shanim, they were also considered valuable, useful years that she used to reach her potential. She did not waste any of her time. She only used it to fulfill her mission. Rashi says something else. Rashi says that at the age of 100, when she was Me'ah Shana, she was like Eslim Shana. And when she was Eslim Shana, she was like Sheva Shanim. What does that mean? At 100, she was 20. And at 20, she was 7. What is Rashi talking about? So Rashi explains. At 100, where she was an old lady already, she had the purity of sin like a 20-year-old. Our rabbis tell us that by the age of 20, we still say a person is clean from sin. Okay, that's a nice aspect to know about Sarah Imenu. She was an old lady, but she had the purity of a 20-year-old. And a 20-year-old, she had the beauty of a 7-year-old. Now this I never understood. When is a lady more beautiful? At 20 or 7? We assume at 20. So what does it say? At 20, she had the beauty of a 7-year-old. Tell me the opposite. Tell me at 7 she had the beauty of a 20-year-old. This I understand. What does that she mean, the 20 to the 7 for beauty? And the explanation is as follows. Who is concerned about beauty more? A 7-year-old or a 20-year-old? A 20-year-old. A 7-year-old doesn't care how she looks. She's not concerned about makeup. She's not concerned about walking out with a certain thing or not a certain thing. Maybe today the girls are different, but at least in the olden days or somewhat normal behavior should be that a girl of 7, these things should not concern. They're not preoccupied about their appearance as much as a 20-year-old. 20-year-old already is marriageable age. They're more concerned, makeup, so on and so forth. They're coming to tell you when it came to beauty, Sarah at 20 had the attitude of a 7-year-old. Not the beauty of a 7-year-old. She had the beauty of a 20-year-old like it was supposed to be. But an attitude like a 7-year-old, it wasn't an issue. She knew she didn't come in this world to impress people in order to bring her physical beauty to the front, to the forefront. Therefore, that she makes that a compliment to Sarah. Gemara tells the story of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was giving a class. And the students fell asleep. It's quite reassuring to know that even in the olden days, students used to fall asleep in Shi'ur. And this was the Rabbi Akiva. Very comforting for the rabbis of our generation when they see students sleeping in class. They say, it's okay, it happened to the Rabbi Akiva also. But the Rabbi Akiva wanted to arouse them. He wanted to wake them up. What kind of business is this? So in the middle of his long dissertation, he stops and says, boys, Esther the queen. They all heard Esther the queen. Oh, they woke up. What is he talking? Purim. They got excited. Esther the queen, she was the ruler over 127 countries. Sheva ve'aslimu me'a medina. In what zechut did Queen Esther merit to rule over 127 countries? So he says, let the great, 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 great granddaughter of Sarah that lived 127 years come and rule over 127 countries. This was his chiddush, 127, 127, as if there's a connection between Sarah and Esther. What did he mean, Rabbi Akiva? What was the depth of this chiddush, and why did he tell it to them specifically then in the middle of the class? I heard from one of my rabbis, on Purim, he told me this, Hadush, Rabbi Takatsky, Sheikh Ye, he said the following. Let's analyze. Obviously, a year in Sarah's life was so valuable and so precious that not only did it bring blessing to herself and to her immediate family, but it was able to bring blessing and bequeath dominion and rulership to her great-great-great-granddaughter. For every year of Sarah's life, Esther was able to rule over one country. 1 year, one country. So he says, let's break it down a little. For every month that Sarah lived, she bequeathed to Esther dominion, not over a country, over a city. A year to a country, a month to a city. For every day Sarah lived, her day was so valuable, it was able to bequeath to Esther dominion and rulership over a town. And for every hour she lived, a village. And for every minute, a neighborhood. And for every second, a block. Look how valuable even 1 second of Sarah Imenu's life was, how she took advantage. It was so packed with doing the right thing that it benefited Sarah Imenu and gave her dominion over blocks, over towns, over villages, over cities, over countries. And Rabbi Akiva turns to his students as if to say, Look how valuable time is. And you're sleeping in the class. And you're squandering your lives away. He didn't have to finish the thought. The students were smart enough to understand that if he's making that connection, the rabbi in his brilliance was giving a musar, was giving a strong rebuke to his students, but in a nice sugar-coated way. But the students certainly understood. Now we have to understand, Haim Tovim, we have to understand in this story, Ephron, who we might call a used car salesman, where Ephron is a very sly, tricky guy. He starts off telling Abraham, take it for nothing. And all of a sudden he ends up charging him all sorts of money. What happened there? Something, where was the metamorphosis in Ephron's behavior here? You can't go from nothing to all of a sudden charging an exorbitant amount. Our rabbis learned from here a lesson. While we learned tzaddikim omrim me'at is a rule. Righteous people, they don't talk so much. They say a little, ve'omrim harbeh, ve'osim harbeh, and they do a lot. Abraham, when he had the guests, he tells him, no, I'm just going to get you some bread, some water. Don't worry about it, nothing. What does he end up getting them? 7-course meal. Tzaddikim always, they don't talk so much. Tzaddikim's behavior translates in action. They talk a little, but they do a lot. Rishaim are the opposite. Rishaim omrim harbeh. And finish the sentence. No. Rishaim omrim harbeh ve'afilu me'at enam osim. And they don't even do a little. Of course, I'm going to do this, and I'll go, and I'll buy, and I'll come. And be careful. If this fellow's a rasha, rest assured, you're not going to get even a little. You will get nothing. Tzaddikim, they say, I'll try, maybe. And all of a sudden, you see, they provided much more than they even said. Ephron is the rasha. Ephron says, I'll give it to you for free. Did he give him anything for free? Did he throw in a token? Did he throw in nothing he gave him? On the contrary, he charged him. So Rav Shvadron asks, what ticked Ephron off? What happened to the change over here? So he tells an interesting story. He says that Rambam was in a challenge. They challenged Maimonides. Is it possible to train an animal to have human traits? Rambam said, no, an animal's an animal. You can't train him. They said, no, we'll train him. So they went and took a cat, and they trained it to become a waiter. It took 6 months to do. And now they invited Rambam to dinner with the king and all the dignitaries. And the cat is walking on 2 feet, and he has a tuxedo on, and he has a tray, and he's serving food, and he's taking orders. He's listening, and he's bringing, and he's doing. The Rambam is not impressed, but everybody else is saying, see, the Rambam is wrong. And Rambam's patient. Now it's time to have the soup, and the cat is coming out with the soup, putting it in front of the king. Rambam takes a mouse out of his pocket. He waits till he gets next to the king. Boom, he lets the mouse loose. All of a sudden, the cat sees the mouse. He spills the soup all over the king's lap. He flips over the table. He's running. He's destroying the whole thing till he grabs the mouse. Rambam says, exactly. Rambam comes along and says, what happened to your waiter? What happened to your, you trained him, you conditioned him. Explanation is, a cat is a cat. Bottom line, that's his nature. You can't, you're right, he can fool you for a while, but once the mouse is dangled in front of his eyes, finished, and then goes back to his old way. Ephron is that cat. He's able to act very nice, very ethical, sure, take it for free, my pleasure, don't be silly, I wouldn't think of taking money from you, you're a prince. But once Avraham starts to tell him, no, I insist to pay money. Once he hears the word money, that's the mouse let out of the pocket. Oh, money! He hears Avraham jingling the coins in his pocket. Now all things are set aside. Ephron's true nature of a greedy man, he can't control it. It surfaces. Now you see the animal come out. It was the dollar bills that Avraham dangled in front of Ephron that revealed his true nature. A greater man would have said, Abraham, please put your money back. I don't want to see it. Chas v'shalom. Ephron sees the monies. I can't control. All right, give me $250,000. This was the lust of money that Ephron had that did not let him do what he was supposed to do. Fine. The next perasha in Hayesara, and the large majority of the perasha, talks about Avraham looking for a prospective wife for his son Yitzhak. The Torah talks about this story at length. It's really amazing. The whole perasha has 105 pesukim. This story takes up 67 pesukim. A large majority of the perasha. It repeats it twice even. The story is told and it's rehashed again. It's told over twice. The Torah spills a lot of ink on this story and there are many lessons to be learned from it. Bezat Hashem and Seudah Shlishi will talk about the lessons. But there's some points that must be made. First of all, Avraham commissions his loyal servant Eliezer to be the shadchan, to be the matchmaker. He tells Eliezer, listen, I want you to go to my family. They live in Haran. And I want you to investigate and come back with the girl for Yitzhak. And swear to me. Swear to me on the name of God that you will not veer from my instructions. I do not want a girl from Canaan. So our rabbis ask her a very strong question. Okay, we understand that Abraham has certain conditions. We discuss his conditions in a minute. But who's he talking to that he makes him swear? Eliezer. Eliezer is the manager of the estate of Abraham. He's managing his portfolios. He's managing his funds. He's managing his real estate. He has the keys to every vault. The Torah says, "Hamoshel bechol asher lo." If you don't trust this man, then forget it. You have to make Eliezer swear. The man has your whole will. He has every cent you own. Eliezer has the combinations. And you make this guy swear? He's not a stranger. He could have just told him, listen, Eliezer, here's the deal. I want you to take a girl from over there, not from over there. Eliezer would have said, okay. Avraham, might we say, is exaggerating a little. Swear to me. Let's swear to me. Am I a crook? Take your keys back if you don't trust me. What does it mean he made him swear? They tell a story, and this story can happen with any one of us, of Yisrael Salanta. Yisrael Salanta went to a hotel and he's sitting in the hotel. And what happens? The owner of the hotel, it seems he ran out of kosher meat. And there was a lot of customers there. He needs kosher meat. He sees the rabbi. He doesn't know who the rabbi is, but he knows he has a beard and he has a hat and he has a long black coat and he's reading a book. He tells the rabbi, listen, are you a shohet? Could you slaughter animals for me? The rabbi says, no, why? I need a shohet, I need kosher meat. I'm sorry, I can't help you. The next day, Rav Zeh Salanta wanted to teach this man a lesson. He goes to him and says, listen, I have a business deal I'm going into, a venture. I need to borrow from you 1,000 ruble. The fellow says, 1,000 ruble? I don't know who you are. I don't even know if you're honest, if you're not honest, if you're a swindler. He says, oh, yesterday when it was a question on kashrut, you trusted my beard, you didn't ask questions, you took it sight unseen. When it came to religion, you have all the trust in the world. Any guy in the street comes along, oh, is it kosher? Yeah, it's kosher. Oh, you can trust him, he knows, of course he knows. But would you lend that guy $5? You wouldn't know. Who is he? I wouldn't give him $1. I don't know, we never saw him before. So when it comes to religion, we trust everybody. We ask anybody a question, and whatever answer they say, regardless of their history, we trust. But when it, why? Because religion is not as important to us as money. When it comes to money, oh, investigate, make a question, make a phone call. Oh, we're very cautious. Avraham is the exact opposite. Avraham, Avinu, when it comes to money, money's not a priority to him. Take my keys, take my thing. So you're going to steal from me? Big deal, so that's only money. So Avraham is very trusting when it comes to the material part of his life. But now we're discussing over here spiritual. We're now looking for a matriarch. We're now looking for the future mother of Israel. We're looking now to perpetuate the teachings of Avraham. This is the greatest decision he's going to make. A very religious decision. When it comes to religion, Avraham teaches us, we cannot leave any room for vulnerability. We cannot leave any chance for mistake that we're going to get burnt. And therefore Avraham says, yes, I trusted you till now with the secondary part of my life. But when it comes to the priority of my life, religion, swear to me, on God's name, that you will not wrong me in this deal. There's another reason why he made him swear. Our rabbis tell us that Eliezer himself had a daughter. And Eliezer actually felt that his daughter was a candidate to become the future wife of Yitzhak. He thought that she was in the running. And therefore, there was a suspicion that Eliezer might go on this mission over here. And, you know, he's always thinking in the back of his mind to do a half job, to come back with a bad report. So Avraham's going to say, okay, well, you didn't find? All right, what do we have? Oh, you know what? Your daughter's okay. Let's take your daughter. So there's a suspicion over here that Eliezer is not going to do the job because his daughter is not going to let him do the right thing. Therefore, Avraham forces him, swear to me, you're not going to bring a girl from Canaan. Eliezer was from Canaan originally. Therefore, you have to swear to me that you're not going to let your bias and your prejudice of your daughter affect the shidduch over here. Let me show you what a tzaddik Eliezer was. After Rivka is finally approved, the pasuk writes Eliezer's reaction. Va'ekod, I danced. Va'ishtahaveh laHashem, I bowed to God. Va'avarech et Hashem, and I blessed God. Look how happy he was when Rivka was found. Could you imagine? There's a boy that's looking for a shidduch. A boy's looking to get married. And their parents that feel that their daughter is very, very appropriate. The boy is a big Tamid Hakam. And it would be a big honor for that family to have a Tamid Hakam as a son-in-law. And the parents are excited. And then they're told, no, it's not for you. And they're burning. What do you mean not for me? We want our daughter. It's perfect. We'll support. We'll do. And they're upset a little. But okay, that's what Hashem wants. Now they hear a week later that that boy got engaged to another girl. Their reaction is somewhat a little on the bittersweet side. Well, okay, what are you going to do? The next one. Eliezer is that man. Eliezer wanted Yitzhak for his daughter. But once he found Rivka, his reaction was, Yishtabach Shemo, I'm so happy. Good for him. It's the greatest thing in the world. Beautiful. He held no grudge. He held no bitterness. That's a great lesson because Eliezer understands what's meant is meant. If this belongs to Yitzhak, then it wasn't for my daughter. And therefore Yitzhak didn't take anything from me. That's our problem. We always think when somebody else gets something, we think they're taking it from us. Because it was coming to us. If you feel like that, sure, you're going to get bitter. If you feel that everybody else's success and everybody else's good things is coming on account of you, and you're actually being robbed, certainly then you're bitter, then you're upset. How dare he have that? How dare he take the shidduch? How dare he? He didn't take it. He's not the one taking things. Borei Olam is giving out the things. Borei Olam decided it's for him, and that's not for you. Therefore, why shouldn't you be just as happy as any other person on the street? A great lesson from Eliezer to not only share in somebody else's burden. Much easier to share in somebody else's burden. You hear somebody, Bar Minan, got sick. Ooh, you feel upset. You go visit them. Haram, I'm terrible. You make dinners. But imagine you heard somebody won $1 million. Are you just as happy for them as you commiserated with them? It's much harder to share in somebody's happiness because you also want the happiness. You see, you don't want to get sick, so it's easy to commiserate because you don't want that. So you can say, hazit, 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 you feel bad. But when somebody else gets something good, when somebody else, all their children got married very fast, that's a good thing. It's very hard to be happy because you want that same thing. Then you're going to think, you know, it's not fair, it's not right. Why? Why him? Not me? Doesn't it? And the Ezra is teaching you, it doesn't work that way. I thought this was coming to me, this shinduch. I had the daughter. I'm Abraham's top student, by the way. I served Abraham for 100 years. Don't you think I get first crack? And for whatever reason was, Abraham says, no, it's not for you. Not for me, not for me. Beautiful. Once we find the girl, who's dancing? Eliezer is dancing. Oh, what are you dancing? You got it? No, not for me. It's for Rivka. He danced as if it was his own daughter. A tremendous trait. Lastly, there's a famous saying. The Gemara says, Kashe zivugan shel Adam. It says finding the right girl or finding the right boy, as we say in Arabic, the nasib, it is so difficult, it is as difficult as the splitting of the sea. Many explanations have been said on this. What is the connection between finding your mate and the splitting of the sea? It's as difficult as the splitting of the sea. What's the comparison? And the Kli Yakar says a beautiful thing. A sea or an ocean, by nature, is a very dangerous element. There's waves, there's fish, there's whales. It's dangerous, an ocean. But if a person does not go in protected, the ocean can drown him, God forbid. We're very careful to our children. Don't go in the ocean, stay out of the ocean. A body of water so large poses a great threat. But at the time of Kiryat Yam Suf, that great threat turned into a salvation. It went from being the most dangerous situation to becoming the most opportune situation. When it split, it actually saved the Jewish people. If it doesn't split, we drown. Now that it does split, we're saved. That's the same thing about boys and girls going out. Boys and girls going out on dates at the inception can be a very dangerous proposition. A boy and a girl going out, if it's not monitored the right way, if there's no guidance, if there's no religious guidance by parents or rabbis or advice from somebody that knows, leaving our children just to go out haphazardly poses the same threat as a great river that can drown, that can cause great problems. However, if monitored, and if the dating process is run according to the halakha in the proper way, certainly it brings a great salvation. It brings great beracha, and it brings great success and great positive results. It's a situation that potentially could be disastrous if it's not monitored the right way. How many boys and girls get into trouble because their parents did not guide them and they get hurt and there's problems and they're scarred for life because the parents weren't on top of it. They didn't know where their children were. A disaster. But if it's monitored and the zivug works the right way, it's like the splitting of the sea. That disaster turns into salvation. A marriage ensues and children are brought into the world and Klai Yisrael perpetuates. Baruch Adonai Le'olam. Amen. Amen.